WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Steven Spender once wrote this about my guest poet W.S. Merwin. He wrote, "It is as though things write their own poems through Merwin. At their best, they are poems of total attention, and as such, they protest against our world of total distraction." Merwin has been honored with the Pulitzer Prize for his poetry, and he won an award from Penn, the International Writers Organization, for his translations. W.S. Merwin grew up in an area of Pennsylvania that has since been strip-mined. He's written many poems about the beauty of the natural world and the consequences of man's desecration of it. He now lives with his wife in Hawaii. Merwin has a new book of poems titled The Rain in the Trees. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him to read a poem, but this one's not about nature. It's about love and memory and having entered the world before the one you love.
Being early. When you were born, I was a small child in a city, and even if somebody had brought me news of you, I would not have believed them. Already I had seen an ape chained in the sun with a bucket of water. I had heard bells calling from wooden towers, stone towers, brick towers. I had seen blood coming through bandages on a hand holding candy and a shadow shining on green water where tall birds were standing, and I knew the notes of streetcars and the smells of three rivers and could have told you about all of them if I had known you were there.
I think that's really a beautiful poem. And I was wondering what got you thinking about being born before your love was.
Well, no, it was the other way around. I mean, of course.
You being born before she was, yes.
Yes, because she's a few years younger than I am.
Yeah.
My wife. She's not very many years younger than I am, but enough for me to think about that. There were several years when she wasn't around.
There's a really striking image in the poem. You say that you'd seen blood coming through bandages on a hand holding candy. And it's amazing how certain images just stay with you. I mean, do you remember when you actually saw that?
Oh, I do. Yes, I can remember. I must have been about 2 years old, and I was playing with some older girls. I mean, I thought of them as thoroughly grown up. They must have been all of 7 or 8, and I was 2. And one of them got hurt one day. And you know, when there are tiny children around, they always try to hush it up and not let you know what happened.
Right.
And I was very curious. And they lived upstairs, and I remember the silence and after the crying stopped, and then the two girls coming downstairs. I was made to wait down at the bottom of the stairs, one of those old houses down in Florida that had wooden steps coming down the back, you know. And I was supposed to wait down at the bottom. And I waited down there because I wanted to find out what happened. They came down, and there was this bandage with the blood coming through, and they both had new pieces of toffee candy that they were eating to make them feel better. I didn't get any.
Was that a very frightening image to you?
Well, it was curious, you know. There's a sort of Buddhist image of what one's existence in life is, that pleasure and pain are always mixed, and they talk about, you know, honey on a razor. It's that funny mixture. It's both exciting and frightening and something that one's both drawn to and repelled by, you know.
Well, one last thing about this poem, Being Early, which you just read. It ends with, "I could have told you about all of them, all of these images, if I had known you were there." And, I mean, that's really like the writer's desire, isn't it, to tell?
Yes.
I mean, to tell people about things. Mm. And I wonder if you can explain your need or your desire to tell, to write, to describe.
If I could explain it, you know, it might go away. It's there all the time. And yet, you know, I don't think anybody ever knows exactly who they wanted. Some poems, you know, that you want to go to one specific person. And sometimes there's a poem in which there's someone, an image over one's shoulder, you know, that you're writing for. But there's always, I think you're always writing for everybody, don't you think? You know, everybody's experience, which they share with you and you share with them, and the experience behind a poem like that is not going to be anybody else's. And yet, if it works, they're going to recognize something in their own lives that is the same.
Well, one of the things that interests me about your desire to tell, your desire to describe, is that you come from what you describe as a reticent family, a family of people who really didn't talk very much at all.
Yes, that's true. But that didn't make any difference. I can remember when I was very young, listening to music, and I don't even think it was very, very interesting or very good music. But I was trying to explain what was wonderful about the music, and there was no way. I mean, nobody. There was no way of getting through to anybody. And of course, this is always there. I think there are always two sides to this thing. Finally, it's impossible to say what any experience is like to anybody else. And yet the miraculous thing about literature is that it does say so much it does allow one to, you know, this much misused word now, share. It does allow one to share experience with other people. Literally share it the way you'd share a piece of bread or something like that, you know, when one person has one part of it and the other person has another part of it. And you recognize something that you have in common. And this is, you know, this is one of the really hopeful things about being alive, that one can do that. Can you imagine not being able to do it at all, and the terrible isolation?
Sure.
Some people suffer that.
Well, you once described poetry as using language as a vehicle for the unsayable.
That's it. It is unsayable. And one makes these kind of incursions on the unsayable, but of course the unsayable is infinite. There's no way, finally, of saying it. But we do say the most extraordinarily intimate and true things sometimes, and it's always amazing that we can do it. When you think that language is something that no one of us has made, it's something that we inherit and pick up as we go along, and it's the word for the color red is the word for all of the colors red, and yet when we use it, we're talking about something very specific, and sometimes people can hear it and see something very specific out of their own lives.
You studied poetry with John Berryman at Princeton.
I did.
And you have a poem that I very much like that you wrote about advice that he gave you about poetry. And I'd really like it if you read that poem for us. And this is, my guess is W.S. Merwin, who has a new volume of poems called The Rain in the Trees. But this is an earlier poem that I'm asking you to read now.
It's out of the book that came before The Rain in the Trees, which is Opening the Hand. And it's now in the selected poems, too. And the poem is called Berryman. I will tell you what he told me in the years just after the war, as we then called the Second World War. Don't lose your arrogance yet, he said. You can do that when you're older. Lose it too soon and you may merely replace it with vanity. Just one time, he suggested, changing the usual order of the same words in a line of verse. Why point out a thing twice? He suggested I pray to the muse, get down on my knees and pray right there in the corner, and he said he meant it, literally. It was in the days before the beard and the drink, but he was deep in tides of his own through which he sailed, chin sideways and head tilted like a tacking sloop. He was far older than the dates allowed for, much older than I was. He was in his 30s. He snapped down his nose with an accent I think he had affected in England. As for publishing, he advised me to paper my wall with rejection slips. His lips and the bones of his long fingers trembled with the vehemence of his views about poetry. He said the great presence that permitted everything and transmuted it in poetry was passion. Passion was genius, and he praised movement and invention. I had hardly begun to read. I asked, how can you ever be sure that what you write is really any good at all? And he said, you can't. You can't. You can never be sure. You die without knowing whether anything you wrote was any good. If you have to be sure, don't write.
Gosh, I like that. At the end, you know, of the poem there, where he gives you that advice that if you have to be sure that your poems are good, don't write. I mean, was that really plaguing you a lot? How do you know if your poems are good?
Oh, no, it was a kind of a great relief. It made me feel that, you know, you couldn't kind of footsie around with it, you know, if you were... We're going to write for the wrong reasons, and I think this is wonderful advice for anybody starting out. You know, if you're going to write for the wrong reasons, you'll reap the results of writing for the wrong reasons. If it's just an ego gratification, or if it's just for money and status and those things, well, you may get those things, but they're never going to be very satisfying.
But, you know, I think a lot of artists are really fueled by self-confidence, that they really believe in their stuff so much. They really believe that it's good.
That's great.
And it's that self-confidence that, you know, enables them to survive different, hard economic times or, you know, other insecurities.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it should never be forgotten. I mean, I see young writers who are very concerned about how big an advance they can get for their first book and the status that it's going to lead them to. And, you know, I understand that, and everything in the society pushes them that way. But I think it's very important to realize that almost anybody that we really admire as we grow up, and if thinking of Van Gogh or Rambo or you know, Beethoven or anybody of the really great figures, There were periods in their lives, in most cases, in which they really had no money, and which the only thing that kept them going was this passion for what they wanted to do. It was Lowell says in Day by Day, in writing about Berryman, he said, we prayed to be obsessed with writing, and we are, you know. It's a sort of, it goes beyond neurosis. That Otto, the psychologist, said that the difference between a neurotic and an artist is that the artist does something with his neurosis.
I like that. Yeah, I have to tell you, a friend of mine was given the task a long time ago of meeting you on a college campus and taking you to the place where you were to do your reading. And he asked the teacher that was bringing you in, how will I recognize Merwin? And the teacher said, you'll recognize him. He looks like a poet. I wonder how you react to that.
There's no way to react to it because, if people think that, that's what they think. I don't know what a poet looks like. I'm glad if people think so.
Well, did you have an image in your own mind when you were coming of age and deciding to be a poet of what a poet's life was, what a poet looks like, what it means to be a poet, that kind of stuff?
I did. I thought that there were certain things you did not do. I thought it was very important to be independent. And to me, it was very important to maintain certain links with things that meant a great deal to me. One of them was the natural world, and I've always felt that. I mean, I think that I've always felt that I had one foot in the city and one foot in a very unurban place, and I still feel that way. The city for me is history. It's the contact with history. But history is not everything. I mean, history comes out of something which is much larger, and we're trying to destroy it. Well, we aren't going to succeed. We're going to make a terrible mess of things around us, but the natural world will survive us, I think.
Is this why you're living in Hawaii now, to be
one of the
more
reasons,
around nature?
I love it there. I think it's important for people to try to live in the way they want to live. And, of course, not everybody can do it. I mean, many people really are caught in circumstances that they really feel they can't control. But a young poet that I met recently talked about in a lecture about having asked people in a lecture that she'd given a few months before. She'd asked a lot of people to put all their books aside and just put a piece of paper on the desk and draw for the next 5 minutes the ideal home. I mean, the ideal place where they would like to live. And that they, you know, they could take it out of any part of their lives, out of their past, out of their childhoods, out of the present or anything. And then she said, all right, now turn the paper over and draw the place where you're living now. And think about the difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, why are you not living where you want to be living? Is it really that you've made so many compromises which may be why you're unhappy with your lives, as many people are?
Well, there's a real short poem I'd like to ask you to read called Witness.
Witness. There are many. The new book is called The Rain in the Trees, and this is one of the trees poems. Witness. I want to tell what the forests were like. I will have to speak in a forgotten language. There's something behind that poem. My feeling that as the kind of imperialism is built into our situation right now. I mean, I hear that 75% of the world's letters now are being written in English. And what does that mean for the gene pool of language, you know? That as that happens, and our point of view does not broaden, in fact, it narrows. And we think that other cultures really are uninteresting. I mean, the oral cultures somehow are clumsy attempts to really be like us. I mean, that's what they're all trying to do and failing. Along with that goes a growing indifference to the disappearance of other kinds of cultures, other ways of being human, other ways of being in the world. And I think that indifference is part of the destruction of the natural world that's going on around us. I mean, the most appalling example of it now is the continuing destruction of the rainforests all through the tropics of the planet, and the effects of that. I mean, whether people in the cities care about trees or anything like that, we do care about breathing, you know, and our oxygen comes from there.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and hear some more of your poems, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is poet W.S. Merwin, and he has a new collection of poems called The Rain in the Trees, and the poem he just read is from that collection. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Poet W.S. Merwin is my guest. You're just talking about the destruction of the forest. Now, you grew up, in part, in an area of Pennsylvania that has since been strip mined. Has seeing that happen to places where your family lived affected you a lot?
I think that was seeing the first strip mine was a kind of traumatic experience that in some ways I never got over. I just stood there, I remember, as a child of about 10, and tears ran down my face. I couldn't believe that anyone would do a thing like that. And I couldn't believe that there was anything worth doing anything like that for. And this was an area that I had known a few months before as a mountainside. It wasn't primitive, primeval forest, but it was beautiful second growth forest. And suddenly here was this great gouge in the earth, about 100 feet deep and about 300 feet wide, with a big steam shovel down the bottom of it, and a lot of water with sulfur in it, and new erosion lines down the sides of the banks, and that was all that was there. And I, you know, it was a shock that I can remember wandering around the rest of that afternoon in a kind of daze, couldn't believe this, and found out what it was. And in a way, I've never come to terms with it. I think that our ability to do that to the world that we've been given, in a way, is something that we're doing to ourselves, and it's something we're doing to our lives.
I want to ask you something else about your family. You talked before about how your family wasn't a very verbal family. You've described yourself as growing up in a kind of bookless home. If that was so, how did you get interested in reading and in writing?
My mother read to me, and she read very well, and she cared about reading. My father was a minister, he's a Presbyterian minister, and you'd have thought he read, but he didn't read very much. But I did care about the books that were read to me, and there was one book in particular about Indians that was a book for children to learn to read from. And I taught myself to read out of that book because I wanted to find out about these pictures, about who these people were in the pictures, you know. And it was a book that began, you know, a man, an Indian man, and so forth. And by the time I got through the book, I learned a tiny bit about Indians and a tiny bit about reading and was able to go on from there. But it's occurred to me that it's rather strange to have learned to read to find out about an oral people and the way they lived.
An interesting contradiction. Since your parents weren't much, didn't read much, when you started to write, did you miss the kind of parental approval and appreciation that you might have liked to have?
Well,
God, that's a great poem, William.
Oh, no, I didn't ever got that. But I tried to write hymns first, you see. They had the first poems that I knew about were the hymns down the church, and I was kind of fascinated by those. And I tried to write some more hymns, and then I thought my father should at least do me the courtesy of using them in the service.
Which he didn't.
He didn't, no.
After college, you went abroad and tutored in several different countries. Did you start to reinvent your life when you were very far away from your home? Embroider little things, change things around?
Well, I think it began to develop a slightly rosy glow. I got very homesick. I was living on very little money. I worked for the BBC for a number of years.
Oh, doing translations for them?
Doing translations for the third program, in the great days of the third program. And so I could live on very little money in London. And I knew that if I came back, I'd have to get a respectable job and probably teach college or something like that. I didn't want to do that because I saw many of my contemporaries getting caught in a kind of fixed career in which they began to feel that they couldn't live outside it. And I felt very clear that I could live outside it and that I wanted to be footloose and independent, and that seemed to be very important. So I stayed away for 7 years, but I was getting very homesick at the same time.
Many of your poems are about memory and memories. Do you trust yours? And does that matter?
Well, what does that mean? You know, of course, one does not remember exactly what's there, but one doesn't see exactly what's there. One sees what one sees, and one remembers what one remembers, and it is a kind of reality. Nobody sees what's there. You know, if we talk about what we're looking at, we describe two different things, you know. And if we, the farther we get away from it, the more it changes. But what's changing is us. And so, you know, the memory, as long as one doesn't pretend that it's historically accurate, it's accurate in a different way, and which is somewhere between historic accuracy and the imagination itself. And one doesn't really, one can control that, but only up to a point.
There's a poem about a memory I'd like for you to read. It's called Waking to the Rain.
Again, the book is called The Rain in the Trees, and there are many trees and much rain. I'm very fond of both of them. Waking to the Rain. The night of my birthday, I woke from a dream of harmony, suddenly hearing an old man, not my father, I said, but it was my father, gasping my name as he fell on the stone steps outside, just under the window, in the rain. I do not know how many times he may have called before I woke. I was lying in my parents' room in the empty house, both of them dead that year, and the rain was falling all around me, the only sound.
Can I ask what did happen that night when
just,
you woke?
And just exactly that.
Was it really a man, or were you dreaming the man?
Oh, I think it was in that state that you are between dreaming and waking. I think I dreamed it, but I don't know. I mean, after all, I was sleeping in my parents' bedroom, and anything could have happened. They had died not very long before that.
Has that happened to you a lot, where you come out of a dream and you think you hear something and you don't know if you did or not?
Oh, not a lot, but fairly often.
Yeah, it's a very interesting state.
Yes.
That's one of the things that interests me in this poem.
Very, very important state. I think you're seeing something. You're seeing something that you don't see in any other state. Dante talks about it, you know, in the Divine Comedy. If you go through it, you find that he makes various transitions by means of various dreams. And there's one place where he talks very, very, very brilliantly, and as always, and very concisely about that state of mind just before one is awake and when one is really asleep, but also partly awake. Another wonderful book on the subject, is James Hillman's The Dream in the Underworld, which was published a year or two ago.
No, you were saying a little earlier that when you were younger and went to Europe after college, you really wanted to learn to be independent and not have to have that 9-to-5 kind of job. You've managed to stay alive as a poet, support yourself. How have you supported yourself over the years? You've not taught, right?
Well, I've taught a little bit. I've taught at Cooper Union.
But you haven't been a full-time professor.
You
haven't been associated for many years with the university, which is the way many poets have supported themselves.
Well, I did manage to earn a certain amount of money for a number of years by translating. And I think it's important not to have very high standards of how, not to have a very high standard of living. I mean, to be able to live, I mean, it never occurred to me that I was going to make a lot of money, and I haven't. But it didn't matter. It's never mattered very much, because the things that I did care about, I cared about so much more than that. So I just resigned myself to the fact that it wasn't going to happen. And as long as I could be independent and could you know, pay the bills, and that was all right. And I've had a number of fellowships and grants. If you average them out over the years, they don't amount to very much, but they've come along at intervals when it was very helpful, you know. That's really how it's been, sort of hand to mouth. But I've been extremely lucky. On the other hand, I think that if you if you start getting yourself into a very secure but rather rigid situation too early in your life, there may be strokes of luck that come your way that you can't use, you know. My first trip to Europe as a tutor was there purely because I didn't have any particular thing that I had to do, and when the chance to do this one came along, I said, fine, I could take it, you know. And it led to other positions like that.
I would like to ask you to read one final poem before we have to conclude. Now, since I've chosen all of the poems so far, I thought I'd give you the opportunity to to choose one you especially would like to read.
Well, what about the first poem in The Rain in the Trees, which is called Late Spring? Coming into the high room again after years, after oceans and shadows of hills and the sounds of lies, after losses and feet on stairs, after looking and mistakes and forgetting, turning there thinking to find no one except those I knew, finally I saw you sitting in white, already waiting. You of whom I had heard with my own ears since the beginning, for whom more than once I had opened the door, believing you were not far.
When did you write that? And what were the circumstances behind the writing of it?
I wrote it in New York in the summer of 1982 sometime. The circumstances. Oh, you mean, well, I was with my wife and I was thinking about meeting her.
Mm-hmm. You know, in so many of your poems, you seem so surprised to have had such a wonderful relationship with one woman. I just seem perpetually surprised in your poems about that.
Oh, I think it's a very surprising thing to be alive, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
And that's the most wonderful thing that can happen, is to have that kind of relation with somebody. I mean, it's the most surprising thing of all.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for reading some of your poems and for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
W.S. Merwin's latest book of poems is titled The Rain in the Trees. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.